This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. Yesterday, I read a story about a police officer in Chicago who was chasing three suspects on foot, and they shot and killed the officer. It was just a few days ago in Houston that a policeman was shot and killed while he was just gassing up his police car. And these kinds of headlines are becoming more and more common. It seems like we're seeing one every few days. The headline in the New York Times this past Monday said that murder rates are going up sharply in several U.S. cities, at least 30 cities, where we're seeing a reversal in a trend of murder and violent crime going down. Why is this happening all of a sudden? We're going to talk about a few reasons for this terrible trend in the United States. In the second segment, we're going to talk to trumpet writer Robert Morley about a lecture that he attended by Oklahoma Senator James Lankford. Here's a man who works in Washington. He's trying to make a difference in the country, but he's bumping up against some major obstacles with the political system there and with the presidential administration. He had quite a few interesting observations that we're going to share with you. And then at the end of the program, I'm going to talk about a stranger in your home that you need to be vigilant about. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. Murder rates are rising sharply in many U.S. cities. That was a headline in Monday's New York Times. The murder rate has been going down for years, but suddenly cities all over the country are seeing a startling rise in violent crime and murder. At least 35 of the nation's cities are reporting increases in murders and violent crimes, or both. In Milwaukee, last year there were 86 homicides. This year, the summer isn't even over yet, and there have already been 104 homicides. In New Orleans last year, there were 98 murders through the first 8 months of the year. This year, 120 so far. In Baltimore, up from 138 last year to 215 this year. In Washington last year, 73. This year, 105. St. Louis last year, 85. This year, 136. Why? Why do you suppose this is happening? Why is this sudden turnaround in a trend just this past year? Well, this New York Times article says nobody knows why. Nobody knows why this is happening. The Washington Post reported on October 26th, we're now averaging more than one mass shooting per day in 2015. And by mass shootings, it's talking about incidents where at least four people are shot, including the gunman. As of August 26th, 238 days into 2015, we've had 247 mass shootings of this type. That was last Wednesday when a black man who was angry about what he considered racism shot two reporters on live television. These stories are coming out more and more. I mean, just about every day one of these things is happening, one after another after another. Why? Why are we seeing this increase in this kind of violence? Here's a quote from this New York Times article. Some officials say intense national scrutiny of the use of force by the police has made officers less aggressive and emboldened criminals, though many experts dispute that theory. Now, that is not the reason for all of the increase. We're going to talk about some of the other reasons a little bit later, but let's be logical about this. We have to recognize cause and effect. And as we've been talking about at the Trumpet on this program, there are high-profile people, including the president, who are saying that they're drawing attention to this problem with the law enforcement in this country. And they're talking about racism, like this is baked into the nation's police forces. The other day on a radio program a couple weeks ago, you had MSNBC's Al Sharpton talking about how black people cannot trust the police, those who are sworn to protect them, how most race-related violence in the past 50 years has been sparked by police violence. Most of the race-related violence is the police's fault. Back in June, the president was talking about this subject. He talked about the legacy of slavery in the United States and how there's discrimination in almost every institution of our lives. This is a direct quote from the president. It's still part of our DNA that's passed on. We're not cured of it. So racism, it's just part of our DNA. That's who we are as a people. So there are some people even that go so far as to say that even black police officers are racist against blacks because they've been absorbed into the system. So these kinds of statements, these are supposedly meant to help us to move toward a solution. These individuals who are making these statements are talking about highlighting these problems so that we can begin to address them. Well, is it working? What are the fruits? What are the fruits of them bringing these types of concerns in front of the American people the way that they are? We've been talking about this at the Trumpet, how these supposed solutions are going to lead to more problems. They're going to undermine the police and their authority. They're going to embolden criminals. They're going to intensify racial tension. They're going to increase hatred and increase violence. Well, it certainly appears that that's exactly what we're seeing happening. This is what the New York Times says. Some officials say intense national scrutiny of the use of force by the police has made officers less aggressive and emboldened criminals, although many experts dispute that theory. But it is a contributing factor. There's no doubt, especially in some cities, that it is definitely contributing to the problem. We've been talking about this. Mr. Gerald Fleury wrote about that in his article, Police Under Attack. It was the cover story of our Trumpet a couple months back. You can find that online at thetrumpet.com, Police Under Attack. But the New York Times says, as in places like Ferguson and Baltimore, tensions over race and police conduct have risen in Milwaukee, where the population is 40% black compared with 6% statewide. And there's no doubt we are definitely seeing increases in violence, both because of policemen who are pulling back and criminals that are stepping up and they're filling that gap, but we're also seeing it in terms of people rising up against the police themselves. Yesterday, there was a police officer in Chicago. He was chasing three suspects on foot. He was shot and killed. CBS reported three suspects, two white males and a black male. Unconfirmed dispatch reports indicated the suspects might have taken the officer's gun and pepper spray. We're just seeing reports like this more and more. Just this past Friday, there was the incident in Houston. A police officer filling his car up at a gas station, someone just came up and shot him in the back, walked up behind him and just shot him, and he fell to the ground, and the man just kept shooting him. This is from the Reuters report about that incident. The county sheriff linked the shooting to anti-police rhetoric following protests against deaths of unarmed black men at the hands of white officers. The police officer in this case, Deputy Darren Goforth, he was white, the suspect was black, and this county sheriff said the department assumed that he was a target because he wore a uniform and bluntly addressed protests against police violence and mass incarceration of blacks. He said, "We've heard Black Lives Matter. All lives matter. Well, cops' lives matter too," he said. At any point where the rhetoric ramps up to the point where calculated, cold-blooded assassination of police officers happens, this rhetoric has gotten out of control. That's absolutely right. The Reuters report continues. The fatal shooting comes 8 months after two New York police officers were ambushed by a gunman who had said he wanted to avenge the deaths of black men in confrontations with police. And just hours after Deputy Goforth was killed, up at the Minnesota State Fair, there was a march of Black Lives Matter protesters. They were marching behind a group of police officers down a highway south of the state fairgrounds, and they were chanting, "Pigs in a blanket, fry 'em like bacon." Where is that kind of sentiment coming from? Are you going to solve problems like that by stirring up resentment, by stirring up racial grievance? Or are you just going to get more and more of these kinds of incidents? What are the fruits? Where does this lead? It makes me wonder, what exactly do the people who say they want justice want? What kind of justice are they talking about? Now, there are definitely people who would view a mass uprising of people on the street. They would look at burning and looting and rioting as some kind of expression of righteous anger. They would see a certain justification for that. Well, you can understand that. You know, on the more extreme side, you have people who are saying, well, this is what we need. This problem isn't going to change unless we get violent. You have crowds that are chanting, we're ready for war, we're ready for war. This is a very destructive trend in this country. There is nothing just about it. This is not justice. This is just destruction. It's hatred. It's evil. How many would actually view the murder of Deputy Darren Goforth as justice? I'm sure they're out there. I'm sure that there are people who would say, well, that's an expression of some kind of righteous anger. You can understand why someone would do that after all of the oppression in this country, why someone would just walk up behind a police officer who's filling his car with gas and just kill him in cold blood. The communities that are experiencing these uprisings in the name of justice, and they're having their businesses torched and looted and destroyed, those communities are suffering. The whole community suffers from that kind of justice. When you have law and order compromised, everybody is less safe. Everybody is less secure. You have whole communities, whole cities suffering because of that kind of justice. Cities becoming less livable because of that kind of justice. And these people who are supposedly seeking to right racial wrongs, are their efforts helping black and other minorities? Are they helping the black community? Well, when you look at the rise in the murder and violence in these cities, who's suffering from that? In Milwaukee, of the 107 murders so far this year, 85 of them were black people who were just murdered. In Baltimore, of the 223 murders so far this year, 200 of them were black people. Do the lives of those people matter? Again, I just have to wonder, what do the people who say they want justice really want? What do they want? Now, I'm not saying that these calls for justice are causing the rise in all this crime. They're not. That's not the entire cause. But there is a strong case to be made that it is contributing to some of the problem, that some of this violence is caused by that kind of rhetoric. I don't see any evidence that it's solving any problem. Gerald Fleury, when he wrote about the Charleston shooting and the response of the people in that community to that shooting and how they forgave Dylann Roof, they looked into the Bible and they saw the attitude that Jesus Christ told us to have toward our enemies and toward those that would hate us and kill us, and they applied that instruction. He talked about this being a real solution to our race problems, the solution that Jesus Christ advocated, forgiveness and trying to love one another. Well, I read an article the other day that said basically that it is racist to say that black people should forgive white people. It's racist to say that basically that we should live according to the teachings of Jesus Christ. But the point of that article in that television program by Gerald Fleury is so profound that when we seek a Bible solution, we're going to have positive results the way that you saw in Charleston. You're going to have a community at peace rather than exploding in violence the way that you've seen in so many of these other cities. When we seek solutions on our own that are contrary to the Bible, well, we're going to have bad results. We're going to create more problems. As it says in Proverbs 14 and verse 12, there's a way that seems right unto a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death. And when I look at these stories that are just coming up more and more often, one or two per week now, sometimes every day, I think, well, surely the people who are calling for racial justice, they wouldn't admit that their solutions are contributing to these problems. They would deny that there's a connection between what they're saying and these kinds of stories. But lately, I've been wondering how many of them would actually view these stories positively in a twisted way, if they wouldn't view the increased violence and mayhem as somehow some kind of a step forward in the kind of justice they're seeking. It's hard to say. I'm just asking a question. The thought entered my mind just thinking about this, but you can say for sure that you see the momentum building here. You see the tempo, the pace of these stories increasing, more and more race-related incidents happening, increased murder rates. And the more these happen, the more they still happen, all the more. It feeds on itself. It's intensifying and growing. I want to just go back to that New York Times article and look at some of the other factors contributing to this rising rate of murder and violence, according to the New York Times. It talks about a number of contributing factors. Here's a quote from this article. Rivalries among organized street gangs, often over drug turf, and the availability of guns are cited as major factors in some cities, including Chicago. But more commonly, many top police officials say they are seeing a growing willingness among disenchanted young men in poor neighborhoods to use violence to settle ordinary disputes. It quotes St. Louis Metropolitan Police Department Captain Mike Sack. He said the killings there had grown out of arguments over girlfriends, food, and even characters on a TV show. It's just petty stuff that gets these young people riled up and angry, and then they resort to violence. The police superintendent in New Orleans said the same thing. It's not an increase in gang violence. It's not an increase in robberies of strangers. He says it's an increase of killings inside homes and cars by people who know their victims, particularly difficult crimes to predict or prevent. He said this is not a situation that can be solved by policing. It speaks to a culture of violence deeply ingrained into a community, a segment of the population where people are resolving their problems in a violent way. They have no morals. They have nothing that restrains them. They're just out of control. They're emotional. They're very angry. And they have no way of resolving these things, no way of dealing with these emotions, except to just lash out in violence. Another quote from the article: in Milwaukee, most of the victims and the suspects in their killings are black men under 30, police data shows, who come from neighborhoods where foreclosures, joblessness, and poverty are also high. Most involve guns and people, both victims and suspects, who have been arrested before. The most common motive in the slangs was not robbery or gang rivalry, but an argument, according to the data. Mayor Tom Barrett of Milwaukee said this: I have to find a way for these young kids to understand that they have a stake in society. It's like they just feel like it's them against society, and they don't realize that they are contributing to making a world that is just a nightmare. They have no stake in it, but they're turning it into a horror show. And here's this mayor just saying, I wish I could somehow help them to understand that they are contributing to this, that they have a part in this, that if you want to live in a world that is worth living in, you have to be a contributing member. You can't just solve your problems by going and shooting somebody. Milwaukee's police chief said there's a very harsh reality at play here, which is the mental calculation of those who live in that strata, that it is more dangerous to get caught without their gun than to get caught with their gun. Again, just a terrible breakdown of law and order They haven't been taught that they have to bear responsibility for their own actions. They're out there looking after themselves. It's more dangerous. They're more afraid of the people on the street who could come after them with a weapon than they are of the police. It's a remarkable situation that you see taking place in the United States today. And it reminds me of a prophecy in Ezekiel 7. This is an end-time prophecy in Ezekiel 7 and verse 23. You can see it in your own Bible. Ezekiel 7 and verse 23, it says, "Make a chain, for the land is full of bloody crime. The land is full of bloody crimes, and the city is full of violence." It's talking about crime and violence spreading to the point that you just have one crime literally following another, just like links in a chain, one after the other after the other. You get to the point where you have mass shootings taking place, more than one per day. And that's exactly what you see happening in the United States today. That's the way God prophesied that it would be. It perfectly describes what's happening in this country today, and it's a very sad state. It's a curse on this nation that has turned its back on God, that has turned its back on the morality, the absolute morals that would govern us, that would help us, that would restrain us. It's turned its back on actual solutions like forgiving one another, trying to love one another, that would say that it's racist to demand that someone forgive or to say that someone should forgive another person. And if you look in that prophecy in Ezekiel 7, in verse 24, it says God is going to punish this nation. It says exactly how he is going to punish, and it's not a pretty picture. It's talking about actually being taken over by a foreign power. We're talking about a curse on our nation that is going to intensify. It's prophesied to intensify. It's prophesied to continue to eat away at this nation's strength and to weaken us to the point where we're actually susceptible to getting taken over by hostile foreign powers. That's what this is leading to. That is what the Bible prophesies, that these headlines that we see overtaking our news sources are leading to. Is that the kind of justice that we want? Because that's the kind of justice that we're going to get.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
In the United States, even though it's some 15 months away, we're in the middle of presidential politics. We're hearing a lot of promises these days about how these individuals who are running for office are going to turn this country around. You know, the U.S. faces a lot of serious problems right now, but is a different government going to really turn things around? Well, last Thursday, Oklahoma Senator James Lankford spoke at a Chamber of Commerce meeting here in our hometown of Edmond, Oklahoma. Senator Lankford is a clear thinker. He's a very sensible man. He's visited here at Armstrong Auditorium a couple of times, always an enjoyable speaker to listen to. And he gave an interesting perspective of what's happening in Washington today. Trumpet writer Robert Morley attended this meeting, and he wanted to share some of Senator Lankford's insights with us. First of all, Robert, can you just tell us your overall impressions of the presentation that he gave?
Sure. It was a very interesting presentation. Obviously, Mr. Lankford felt very passionately about many of the topics that he brought up. He talked about the EPA. He talked about government regulations. He talked about the economy, about oil, the Iran deal, and also the one way he thought that America could solve almost all these issues, what it boiled down to in the end.
So his mind is on a lot of the same things that our minds are on, that we talk about a lot on the program, on the trumpet.com in our magazine.
Absolutely. These are big issues. talking about nuclear negotiations with Iran, for example. I mean, that's an issue of human survival. So these are meaty subjects that he delved into.
And he has, he's right in the middle of all of this. He's seeing this from a firsthand perspective, from his position there within the Senate. What sorts of insights did you see that he had on some of these issues?
Yeah, I think to me that was some of the most fascinating aspects of his presentation. It was information that you wouldn't necessarily get from an AP news report, for example, just because he is meeting with people and working the halls of Washington in a way that the rest of us don't get to do. But for example, he talked about the Iranian nuclear negotiations and this deal that has been worked out with the Obama administration and Iran. And one of the points he brought out is just how he cannot understand why we are making this deal. A member of the audience asked him and said something along the lines of, the way you're describing this deal, we just don't get anything out of it. It's like we had all the cards going in. We had them under the sanctions, their economy was crippled, and then we just folded. We gave them everything, and we don't get anything except inspections in which we don't really have any say in the inspections, and even those are very, very weak. And the Iranians themselves are involved with providing the samples, for example, for those inspections. And the question was just like, well, you know, why is President Obama doing this? Like, it doesn't make any sense. And one thing that hit me was that Senator Lankford didn't really have a very good answer on that. He just said, you know, it doesn't really make sense. The only thing I can come up with is that on some level, the president actually believes that by making this deal, it will make it less likely for America to actually have to attack Iran at some point. But even that answer that he gave when he was giving it, he didn't seem convinced. So to me, it was just like, here he is, an insider in Washington, looking at this and not being able to find any logic for this deal that's going on.
Well, first of all, with respect to that deal, did he give any insight on just the dangers that this poses to Israel or to the United States?
Yeah, absolutely he did. He was very strong about this, and this is probably why, I mean, he's so passionately against this deal, although by the looks of things, it sounds like it isn't going to get blocked. But he did say this is a deal that actually has Democrats on the same side as Republicans to stop it because it is so dangerous. One thing he mentioned is the nuclear deal there's three aspects of it. There's the nuclear enrichment, there's the ability to deliver a nuclear weapon, and there's the ability to detonate a nuclear weapon. And he said this deal takes away, number one, the ability, Iran gives up its nuclear stockpile of uranium, but it does nothing to stop them from enriching more in the future. And to points number two and three, developing a weapon and developing a detonating device, it does nothing to impede it. They're allowed under the terms to continue their advancement on those two areas. He said the deal does nothing to slow that down except give them an extra $130 billion to advance their programs. And he said this is absolutely ridiculous that we would sign a deal like this because he said that it's a bad deal. And he mentioned that the French, one of the French lead diplomats on this deal has actually come to Washington to lobby Washington to reject this deal, to lobby members of Congress and the Senate to reject it. This is a French diplomat. And he said, we need to reject this deal because it does nothing to stop Iran. And if you do reject it, it'll just send a deal back to be renegotiated and you'll get a better deal. It'll show the Iranians that they aren't going to get what they have right now, and you'll have an opportunity to get a better deal. So he was saying that, you know, when the French are on board with rejecting it, don't believe this narrative like the whole world is for this deal that everybody's been hearing.
So here's Senator Lankford there in Congress, a passionate voice opposed to this deal. And if I understood you correctly, he's pretty well conceded the fact that they're not going to have enough support for blocking it, that they would be able to overwhelm a presidential veto.
Right. Those weren't his exact words, but that was the impression that I was left with just from hearing him talk about the issue.
So he was talking about Iran. You mentioned the EPA as well, the Environmental Protection Agency. This is another issue that we've been talking about, and just how damaging to America's economy some of these new regulations coming down will be.
Yeah, he did. He made a big point about that. He said that the EPA has become a threat to the well-being of America as opposed to a servant. He talked about how they're taking 40-year-old laws and reinterpreting them in a way that no president has ever done or has ever dreamed to do. He gave the example of the recent regulations on carbon dioxide emissions by power plants. And then he also talked about the Navigable Waters Act, this regulation that has given the EPA authority to regulate any waters that boats can navigate up and down on, and how they've taken law, a squishy law, as he called it, that Congress created, and they're reinterpreting that to mean they have jurisdiction over any stream, a gully, or even dry creek riverbed that potentially throws in, or that potentially flows into a river that is under their regulation. He said that it essentially gives them jurisdiction over the vast majority of America and farmland that they've never had their fingers in before. And he said there's lawsuits now that are dealing with this, and he called it a serious threat to America and a huge growth in government.
So he can see it from his perspective in a way, like just seeing all of the different areas that this touches people's lives. Is he talking to people in the country who are being affected? You know, their livelihood, their businesses that are being impacted by what the EPA is doing.
Well, in terms of the EPA, he didn't give a lot of examples. He talked about a farmer who had tried to build basically a dugout or a watering pond for his cattle, and the EPA didn't like that he had changed the drainage, and now so they're moving into, you know, farmland because of the potential of changing runoff can affect rivers. And he said that this is now the next battlefront in terms of how big can the federal government get. This is he called this a states issue. He said the states have all the tools they need to decide how much they need to regulate, you know, farmers' fields that, you know, when it rains there's runoff coming off of it. In other aspects, he seems to be hitting the ground, talking to people being affected. He talked about the medical industry, healthcare. He talked about the impacts of Obamacare, how he's saying that they're now starting to be felt, and we are going forward, going to start seeing a lot more of these price increases as they're being passed down. He compared the impact on the healthcare industry to how the oil industry is being impacted as the price of oil has fallen from $100 per barrel down to $38 per barrel. So he said basically that there could be a crisis coming in the healthcare industry as well.
How much frustration is there, say, within Congress? We've been talking about all of these areas where the executive branch has essentially been negating and undermining the constitutionally prescribed power that Congress is meant to have. And there even seems to be a certain lack of willpower among, say, congressional leadership to preserve those powers and to ensure that they're checking the executive branch the way that they should. Senator Lankford really strikes me as, someone who would be much more interested in trying to preserve the construction of the Constitution. How much frustration is there by, on his part and maybe among others in Congress who don't necessarily go along with the Republican leadership that is permitting this kind of erosion of power in Congress?
Yeah, great question. He seemed certainly to be frustrated with the direction that it's going. He gave some examples of how Congress has been losing its power due to executive actions and due to the increase in the power of federal agencies. He talked about how he said this administration is making a habit, or they seem to be purposely seeking out what he called squishy laws, or laws that weren't clear and could be interpreted in different ways. And he said 40 years ago, the courts made a ruling that said, you know, when Congress makes a law, and if it's unclear the intent of the law, they set precedent not to send a law back to Congress and say, fix this law, reword it, do whatever you need to do, but side with the government experts. So, for example, with the laws with the EPA or with some of these other government agencies, if there's room for confusion in those laws, it's not clear, the courts have said, well, We'll give the benefit of the doubt to the government agencies. They're the experts on this to decide how to interpret it. And he said that has just come back to bite Congress, because all these laws now, as at present, whatever government agency you look at, now the ability to interpret what it means is going to the government agency. And that basically comes down to who the president appoints to be at the top of these agencies. So, you know, the EPA or whatever agency it is, it's whoever the president appoints. They basically interpret those squishy laws the way they want to, and the courts are coming down on their side, essentially taking the power away from Congress.
So the people who are going to Washington, who are elected, who are sent into the House of Representatives and into the Senate, trying to do the business of the people, their hands are tied by an executive branch that is not paying attention to the mandates that Congress sends to them.
Absolutely. If you look at what has happened during the course of this administration, a lot of people argue that, yes, previous administrations have all done executive orders, et cetera. But if you look at not only the number, but the types of executive orders, what we've been seeing happening in this country over the last 8 years is far beyond what has happened in any previous administration.
What is the solution? Senator Lankford is looking at this, and he's trying to take steps to get things done. And I would imagine that you're seeing dead ends. And, you know, a man in his position, certainly he would have to have a certain amount of faith in the system to work in order to do his job. And yet he has to be frustrated at seeing those things that he feels like, well, we tried that and that didn't work. We're going to try this, and this probably isn't going to work. How does he approach, you know, the problems facing the nation?
Right. Well, he did at one point in his lecture, he did make the point, like, we've been talking a lot about a lot of heavy things here today. And he said he tried to give those listening in the Chamber of Commerce there, those members, hope that things were getting done in Washington. He mentioned, for example, that this year alone, there's been some days in the Senate where they've passed as much legislation as the Senate did in all of 2014, when there was the gridlock between the Democrats and the Republicans there. So he said, look, there is hope. There are some things we're doing. But at the same time, his message was very much that Washington can't solve these problems. His message was that if you're looking for some guy in Washington, some bureaucrat or some elected person in Washington to solve these problems that were that are increasingly becoming evident in the country, he said, that's the wrong hope. And his take-home message that he left us all with as he was wrapping things up was that if America wants to solve its problems, we have to start by fixing our families. We have to start fixing our families, because he said, you know, nations are made up of people. And he said the only way we can get our nation on the track that we want it on is if we start fixing our families. And he encouraged all the members of the Chamber of Commerce to do what they could to help out. He encouraged them to commit themselves to mentorship problems, working with children from broken families to help them, because he said, you know, the future of our nation depends on the next generation. At the same time, he said, this isn't an easy, quick fix. You know, he's very realistic about that. He said that, you know, this is something that could be generations before you could see the results of fixing our families, because there are, you know, so many generations of broken households in this country.
I respect Senator Lankford immensely, and I feel like so many of the politicians that you see go into Washington, that's kind of like being thrown into this maelstrom of bureaucratic noise, and, you know, trying to make sense of this, almost like living in a Kafka novel or something, where there's so many impossibilities all around you, and gridlock is just a reality of your everyday life. I could see, you know, you see someone, so many of the people that go there, they become careerist politicians that don't really do a whole lot other than look after their own interests, and they end up getting corrupted by that system. And you can see how that would be difficult to avoid given the state of politics in Washington today. It is refreshing to hear. It certainly is true that we have to take responsibility for ourselves and make sure that we really are doing what we can to build our families at home, to make sure that we're educating our children to be as responsible, as upstanding citizens as possible. But at the same time, you look at, even on that front, America is failing in a lot of ways, failing the next generation, failing to educate them, failing to raise responsible citizens. And the future of the country is in their hands. There's a lot to fear in that respect as well.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you for sharing these insights with us, Robert. We appreciate you coming in and talking to us about this.
You're welcome.
It's time for today's last word.
If you came home and you found a strange man teaching your kids to punch each other or trying to sell them all kinds of products, you'd kick him right out of the house. But here you are, you come in and the television is on and you don't think twice about it. Dr. Jerome Singer of Yale University made this wise observation. Do you control the television in your home, or does it control you? Almost every U.S. household has at least one, and it's typically on 7 hours a day. The average American adult spends over 1,700 hours a year gazing at it. Millions of Americans are so addicted to TV, they meet the criteria for substance abuse in the official psychiatric manual. Statistically, a young person turning 18 will have spent more hours with this stranger than doing anything else except sleeping. 6 out of 10 children watch it without supervision. 4 out of 10 keep one in their bedroom. What is all this TV doing to us? Well, first, the hours devoted to television can never be reclaimed for something productive. And it's not the most refreshing diversion. After an hour or two of television, people tend to be cranky, irritable, and tired. Research shows that people don't respect themselves for watching television, don't enjoy it much, and by and large, wish they would quit. Does that describe you? Children who watch a lot of TV show a reduced capacity for creative imagination, concentration, and delayed gratification. Images on screen change on average every 4 seconds, shrinking our attention spans and creating deficiencies characteristic of learning disabled children. Then there's the content of the shows. None of us can watch without picking up ideas, values, and patterns of behavior. It shapes our sense of what's normal, what's funny, what's beautiful, what's cool, even what's right and what's wrong. Even children's programming is loaded with depressing and wrong messages, not to mention the fact that 10.5 minutes of every hour are devoted to advertisements for things they probably don't need or that could even be bad for them. On top of that, young people often end up watching adult programs that can feature violence, drunkenness, sexual promiscuity, and other evils. And in effect, our children are eavesdropping on the adult world, picking up lies and faulty behavior as they go. TV portrays a horribly distorted, unhealthy, unrealistic picture of sexuality. It focuses on the perverse and ignores negative consequences of its wrong use. Immorality is made to look normal, with few or no kickbacks. TV also promotes materialism. Among heavy TV users, the feeling is strong that certain material goods are necessities, whereas light TV users usually consider the same goods luxuries. So television can make us dissatisfied with what we have, no matter how much, no matter how lavish. Other common messages on television, pinpointed by media researcher Dr. Robert Kuby, include these. Authority is evil. For everything, there's a quick fix. Young is better. Open and unfilled time is not desirable. In fact, it can't be tolerated. Violence is acceptable. Religion is unacceptable. Michael and Diane Medved's book, Saving Childhood, shows how TV additionally bombards us with messages encouraging impatience, self-pity, insecurity, and pessimism. Then there's the persistent foul language and gross humor, the coarse communication and shameless disrespect. the shallowness and lies mandated by political correctness. Add to these the ways that television trains us to root for the bad guy, to smile at lawbreaking, to cuddle comfortably with compromise as a way of life. What would we do if we caught a school teacher trying to feed these concepts to our children? Now, many people say, I know, it's terrible, isn't it? I can't believe they show that stuff. Yet, so many of us keep watching, convinced that we can handle it, while it gradually sculpts and shapes the way we think, the way our children think, how we behave. What we see on television isn't called programming for nothing. That's not to say there are no positives to television. There are educational programs. It can be relaxing, even bonding if used judiciously with genuine moderation. But the danger is that we grow comfortable with televised sin after a lifetime of programming. This is an area of family life we cannot be careless about. Don't let this stranger into your home unchecked. Keep a close eye on him. Limit his influence. Don't let your kids spend time with him alone. Scrutinize how he affects you and your family. And if you need to, kick him out. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to our monthly news magazine, The Philadelphia Trumpet. Send us your thoughts or your questions by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Follow us on Twitter @@thetrumpet_com. Find us on Facebook and Google Plus by searching for Philadelphia Trumpet. I want to thank my guest today, Robert Morley, and my technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with this thought from Arnold Glasow. A good leader takes a little more than his share of the blame, a little less than his share of the credit. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice, 101.3 KPCG, and on the web at kpcg.fm.